the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines give people hope that there's finally light at the end of the tunnel. But the year 2021 will see uneven economic recovery, continued geopolitical tensions, and more. How can companies stay ahead of the curve in a volatile world? I spoke with Steve Wilford, partner for Asia Pacific Global Risk Analysis at Control Risks, on how businesses should manage those risks. Hello, Steve. Thank you for joining us. Control Risks.
Hi.
Control Risks just rolled out the Risk Map 2021. Do you have any good news for us?
Control Risks generally is a business is not the department of good news. But I think from the perspective of the pandemic, I mean, the obvious one that's surrounding us all, and particularly in Asia, is the prospect now coming into view of at least the beginning of the end of the pandemic, as we see varying degrees of vaccine rollout. It's a lot better news in some jurisdictions around the region, as we know, in that regard. I mean, obviously, without wanting to be too cynical about it, there's been, to a certain extent, winners and losers in this. I mean, China is obviously coming out of it very well after going into it terribly. Other places like Vietnam have had, quote unquote, a good pandemic. South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, etc. Singapore, after ups and downs, is doing really well. So, you know, we're a business risk consultancy, and that good news is actually being reflected in the interest our clients are showing in terms of new deals, new investment opportunities. We're really seeing an uptick in that, which to me is a reflection of that optimism. So yeah, there's your good news.
Yes, good. The rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines give people hope that life will return to a certain degree of normality. Mm. The pandemic is far from over. How should companies cope with the new normal of doing business when there is certainly governments around the world would impose some sort of travel restrictions?
Yeah. Let me take your sort of preamble there around rising public hope that we're seeing an end to this dreadful illness. So, I mean, as I just said, mm-hmm. in my good news spot, the macroeconomic figures are reflecting rising optimism. But I do think I have to warn people around expectations not quite meeting reality, at least in 2021, if not 2022, because the whole second half, very, very strong economic outlook for the region is predicated on an awful lot of fairly shaky assumptions around the very rapid and linear rollout of vaccines in a very uniform manner across multiple jurisdictions around the region. Frankly speaking, that's not going to happen. There's going to be winners and losers. There's going to be hares and tortoises in this race. So you're going to see a two or three step emergence from pandemic, which for companies creates enormous operational difficulties when you don't have that uniformity. And then of course there's other assumptions like the virus isn't going to mutate again, you know, which is a huge assumption, as we know, given the mutant strains that are emerging in UK, Brazil, South Africa, etc. So there's a danger that the surge in rising expectations and optimism that we're seeing, and I think, you know, to a certain extent, rightly in Asia, could sort of crash against that, causing a collapse in optimism. But that's obviously very, very difficult to predict. My point is really that I think, you know, we're right to be optimistic, but that sense of optimism is predicated on some fairly shaky assumptions.
So while companies should hope for the best, how should they prepare for the worst?
Yeah, well, I would say I was very lucky through the pandemic. Don't take that the wrong way, but I was very lucky through the pandemic to work with a lot of businesses trying to manage the crisis. And it was a very, very interesting experience because really it sort of cut in two distinct directions. There were companies that felt they were fighting for their lives and they were completely focused on the day-to-day and absolutely honed in on the tactical. Most of them did okay. They're sort of crawling out of the hole, so to speak. But I think the companies that impressed me the most were the ones that did that. They did do that. They were really micro and tactical and very operationally focused and, you know, hyper cost controlling, etc. But they never lost sight of the strategic piece. They were constantly, even during the eye of the pandemic, thinking about how is the world going to change coming out of this? How is our pathway to market going to change? How are our ways of working going to change as a result of this? And their baseline assessment was there's no going back. Companies that are working on the principle that things are going to go back to quote unquote normal are probably working on the wrong principle. We're going to see a world that has changed, a world that has moved on. This is going to be a progression into something new. And the businesses that get that and have thought strategically throughout this very immediate crisis are the ones who are going to be the winners in it.
Welcome to the new normal.
Exactly.
Now that we have just covered the public health aspect of the risk, let's turn to geopolitical risks. While there is a Washington consensus to be tough on China, how is the Biden administration China policy different from the Trump administration?
Ooh, well, you've got two presidents, outgoing Trump, incoming Biden, who really couldn't be more diametrically different as people and as thinkers. Obvious statement. But of course, it is interesting to see the incoming Biden administration sticking with the tariff pressure that Trump created, sticking with and focusing on the control, the export controls piece around strategic exports, technology exports, etc., and the Buy American thing, all holdovers from the Trump era. And to a much lesser extent, a holdover is the scrutiny of human rights. And there's a difference there, I think. The Biden administration will put more emphasis on that. And we've already seen that in statements coming out of the White House. And I think the Biden administration will come under pressure from the broader Democrat Party to ensure that focus is not lost. So there's continuity there. But I think the key difference is obviously the delivery system. And if you're in business, you don't have to stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning in Asia waiting for Donald Trump to tweet something to get an understanding of where US foreign policy is going. The Biden administration issues statements out of the it does high level diplomatic exchanges, and then it goes through a formal channel of telling the global media about it. It's not particularly visceral. It's much more process driven, and it's introduced a much greater degree of predictability. I think it's taken the heat to some extent particularly out of geopolitical relations with China, and it makes business, to keep bringing it back to business risk, I think it, for us trying to work out where on earth the US-China feud is going, it brings a degree of predictability. And let me nail it for you. I think the US-China feud is it's not going to go away. It is going to trundle on roughly using the same levers that the Trump administration used. But I think the sort of the whole visceral nature of it is going to die down a little bit. And that's both from the US side and from the China side. We often talk about this exclusively from a US perspective, because under Trump, it was Trump acts, China reacts. I think in the year ahead, you're going to see a much more proactive China, actually, in the diplomatic sphere, which could potentially be a good thing and a bad thing.
So should we expect a reset in the bilateral relationship or the continuity of U.S.-China rivalry in the years ahead?
The answer is, to paraphrase Yitzhak Shamir, probably yes and no. That's a really weaselly answer. But yes, in terms of you're going to see the U.S. and China, I think, use things like the climate emergency as an opportunity to collaborate, as an opportunity to appear on the world stage together. I think that will be a useful tool of engagement. That's going to happen. But equally, as I just mentioned, the Biden administration is not going to take the pressure off as far as the rivalry with China is concerned. Because this isn't, it's not about the South China Sea. You know, it's not about a few you know, disputed rocks. It's a technological rivalry, and it's a rivalry between a superpower and a state that believes its rightful place at the superpower table is being denied to it, and that's a very difficult rivalry to resolve.
So what are the possible different scenarios in terms of U.S.-China strategic rivalry?
I think the scenarios are actually fairly narrow, from grumpy to really grumpy, to use the technical term. So by grumpy, I mean the more benign scenario in the year ahead is going to be all the things I just described, in terms of rivalry levels, human rights, export control, so on and so forth. That's going to remain in play, but it's not going to be used as an aggressive weapon. It's going to basically sort of stumble on in its present form, and you're not going to see massive escalation. And both sides are going to make efforts to just keep the situation under control. I think that's probably the most benign scenario for 2021. The less benign scenario is same again, but both sides give in to domestic exigencies rather a lot more. On the Biden side of things, probably, you know, bowing to demands from the left of his party to really get tough on the three things that China hates America talking about the most, which is Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Xinjiang. From China's perspective, all domestic issues, don't even go there, United States. So that would be escalatory if the Biden administration has to feel that it needs to pander to that. At the moment, it's not particularly interested in really revving that up, with 500,000 Americans dead and a pandemic still ripping through the country. Domestic issues and the politics of the domestic are really at the forefront at the moment. Let's see how that plays out towards the end of the year. So that's the second scenario, if you like. And from the Xi Jinping perspective, which we shouldn't forget, again, there's a general presumption that China has been a winner in the pandemic race. That's a misconception. I think it's the Communist Party has spent a lot of political capital fighting this thing. The economy, yes, is growing extremely fast, but relative to historic China growth rates, not that fast. And you know, Xi Jinping's perennial challenge of keeping the Chinese middle class happy is going to roll on. And unfortunately, when they get grumpy, when the goodies are not handed out by the Chinese economy to the extent that group of people expects, there's a tendency in Chinese foreign policy to do ultra-nationalistic bread and circuses things and really sort of bang the drum about sovereignty, etc. And that will be escalatory. So those are the dangers. So it's grumpy to benign, grumpy to escalatory. Those are the two scenarios I'd give you.
So it's a pretty gloomy picture in terms of U.S.-China relations.
But it's manageable. And if you're doing business in the US and you're doing business in China, there's still a tightrope that you can walk along, and you can still run really successful businesses in both. But yes, it's got harder.
Yes. The US government under the Trump administration had issued several sanctions against some Chinese companies. And more recently, China's Ministry of Commerce published new rules to prohibit Chinese companies and individuals from complying with the punitive measures. How can multinational companies deal with complying issues in the age of sanctions? And what are they allowed or not allowed to say or do?
Yeah, we're spending a lot of time thinking, looking, advising clients on sanctions risk. Some of the Chinese businesses that have faced sanctions are huge multi-sector conglomerates with thousands and thousands of entities, very difficult to track which parts of the economy they're in, very, very difficult to avoid. But notwithstanding that, I do think companies get a little bit hung up on sanctions risk versus regulatory risk in China, because there's a lot going on in the Chinese economy around industrial policy, around governments, around environmental regulation, around cybersecurity, that I think companies invested in China have to be far more across if they're going to succeed. And to answer your question, in order to succeed, you have to, I'm afraid, devote an increasing amount of time and resources to addressing those issues, to finding out where exactly you sit in terms of your sanctions exposure, yes, but also in terms of those other things that I mentioned. How do you engage? This is often forgotten. The Chinese government is actually, on many levels, extremely accessible and can be negotiated with. What are you doing in that regard? What kind of resources are you you deploying to ensure that your voice is heard and you are getting the full understanding from the regulators governing your sector that you're in the right place? You're moving with the spirit of what they want to do, because it's not as clear as it is in the West. A lot of it is inference. A lot of it isn't hammered out in concrete regulation. And the regulation that does exist is often a study in vagueness, precisely so the Communist Party can deploy it as it sees fit. So you've got to understand what is fit, and that requires a negotiation. So those are the kinds of coping strategies that you need to have in place if you're going to succeed in walking the tightrope that I mentioned earlier.
Let's switch gear a little bit, talking about business operation. Many companies were forced to go digital last year due to COVID-19. While digital transformation has unleashed new opportunities, what are the short and long-term risks business should be mindful of?
I would say there's two biggies here for us in Asia, actually. And the first one is to an extent, I think, more manageable. And that is, I mean, as we know, and anybody listening to this who's running any kind of scale of business will know that you had to rapidly roll out a lot of tech, a lot of investment, perhaps not with the best oversight, in order to get to grips with the emergency of remote working, the challenge of sudden supply chain management without actually having managers on the ground, all that kind of thing, that those technical challenges. And that rapid expansion has left quite a number of companies more exposed than they were to hijack by cyberspace, whether that's criminal hackers or that's state-sponsored cyber attackers, so on and so forth. There's that degree of exposure. But I think that will pass, and companies will catch up with that. And I think several companies that I'm dealing with are more than across that. I think that the second biggie is a bit more challenging, and that is a structural change in the realm of cyberspace. That sounds quite grandiose, so let me explain. I think a lot of us are familiar with the concept of data nationalism, where we've seen this right around the region, where grumpy governments have said to companies with international footprint, sorry, stop playing with our people's data in a different country. We want it all to come home. Chinese data for Chinese people, and so on and so forth. That's been a pressure on firms in terms of how they manage data. We also know that's not just an Asia thing. The Europeans have been busy in that regard, to a much lesser extent, the Americans. So that's data nationalism. But what we are now seeing in our region is a transition from that to what I would call digital sovereignty. And that's a much bigger thing. That is governments asserting what they consider to be their sovereign rights over a much sort of broader tranche of everything that's in cyberspace, from payments platform, e-commerce, obviously the content that goes into cyberspace. Increasingly, it will be around artificial intelligence. Governments want to control this. Of course, the scion of digital sovereignty is China, but it's not the only one. We're seeing a rapid game of catch-up by the Vietnamese, the Thais, the Singaporeans, dare I say it. They are all right around the region, sort of playing with elements of expanding digital sovereignty. And that is going to be far more of a headache, I think, than hackers in the year and years ahead for us trying to run multi-jurisdictional businesses.
Businesses should be more prepared in the years ahead. Thank you very much, Steve.
No problem. Thank you.